Grave Tone.
Welcome to Grave Tone Podcast, where horror comes to life in every form it takes. I'm Megan.
I'm Arthur.
Okay, so Jonathan Jan's back for the second time with us. Thank you so, so much for hopping on to chat with us again.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a blast last time we talked. This is going to be amazing, too. So excited to be here.
Nice. Thanks so much. We have very interesting questions for you, hopefully. Because you just had a book release, which is always exciting,
yeah.
Or a re-release, from what I understand. And then there's also potential adaptation talks. Maybe we can get some info on that. So
if you're allowed, we're not going to.
If you're allowed. Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
So from what I understand, Marla released on August 18th, which was really cool. I saw all the posts that she did. It's very good to see that there's a lot of people talking about it, which is amazing. And it initially, and correct me if I'm wrong here, from what I found is that it was initially released in 2022. But it was only a limited run. Is that right?
That is exactly correct. Yes. 500 copies in a limited edition hardcover from Earthling Publications. And that was it. Yep.
Wow. Talk about a limited release. My God.
That's very limited. I feel like those books are like rare now.
You know? That's it. You very rarely get anything like that now.
Yeah, they are. They are. That one specifically was really rare. Paul Miller, the publisher at Earthling, he's just an amazing person. And here's something unheard of. He pays early. All right.
Oh. You know, like
we hear all these horror stories about publishers not paying at all. He pays early. And he said that Marla was the most requested post sellout book he's ever had. And if you start to look like through his list of authors and books, that's pretty extraordinary. So Marla was very much in demand. And I'm so happy that it's finally getting a wide release.
Absolutely. That sounds amazing. If people are actually asking for it after it's been completely sold out, there's genuine interest to it. Speaking of which, how did the release go? Like it's been, a few days so far.
It went so well. Yeah. So like on a nuts and bolts practicality level, it went super well. Every like independent bookstore that I've seen has carried it. Barnes & Noble, I do this. This sounds obsessive, but Barnes & Noble has this feature where you can look up like within 100-mile radius of a specific zip code, if these Barnes and Nobles listed on this sidebar have your book. Mm-hmm. And I'm always just curious to see like how much market penetration, whatever you want to call it. I want to see like how many places have it. And it was something like between 85 and 90% of the 700 plus Barnes and Nobles in America had Marla. So like on a practical, like literal level, it was really wide and did really well in that way. But then as you're talking about like on an anecdotal social media kind of level, it was also really exciting because I just saw it everywhere and I'm still seeing it everywhere. So all the signs seem positive. I'm not, I don't have all the numbers, but I feel pretty good about it.
I've seen a ton of posts about it. Like it seems to be getting a ton of traction. So that's really exciting as well. We want people to go and read the book. So without getting into too much, can you walk people through sort of what the premise of the novel is?
Absolutely. So there's a house on the edge of this town called King's Branch. It's actually out in the country. And there live a woman named Marla and her mother, Irene. And that's about all anybody knows about them. They are recluses. They're rarely glimpsed. And there are all these urban legends about them. And some say Marla is a witch. Some say she's a prisoner to her mother. And there are all these different perceptions and opinions and rumors about Marla. And what we get to do in the novel, well, first of all, there's also like a series of murders in this small town that might connect to Marla. So that brings in this police detective named Carl. We see her story, or we see his story and Marla through his lens. And then there's a social worker named Annie who has some connection to Marla. She has this vague memory of Marla from a long time ago. So we see her through Annie's eyes. And then there's this 21-year-old college student named Dylan who perceives Marla as this beautiful young woman in whom he's very interested. And so he has a very different perception of Marla. So our look at Marla, our perceptions of Marla, opinions of Marla are constantly shifting and changing, but she's definitely kind of the center, the axis on which they all spin.
Oh, I love that. It's like multiple, almost unreliable narrators in their own way, because nobody can really tell you what Marla is like. Is she dangerous? Is she just somebody who's been misunderstood? Yeah. You know, there's like multiple aspects to it. That's really cool.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Nice. That sounds very interesting. Yeah. I am definitely, you know, interested in picking that up.
Pick it up.
Of course, 100%. We did. I mean, look, I devoured Veil.
Yeah.
So this one for sure, I'm going to devour it as well. So
thank you, my friend. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Of course. I wanted to know. So, you know, we said that it was 500 copies initially released. Now it's a much bigger release. It was, what, 4 years in between? Like, how did that feel for you? Like, you knew that people wanted the book, but it was also unfindable, essentially. Yeah. Like, what do you do with that as an author?
Well, I'll pull back the curtain here and give you some insight. If you want to hear about like how Absolutely. That all went
yeah.
down. So Paul Millard Earthling, he had worked with a lot of authors I love, like Josh Mallerman, one of my best friends, and some others. And so I wanted to work with him. And so Marla was a book that I just completed when he and I started to talk. And I was like, well, you know, do you want to do this one? And he read it and loved it. So he did it, right? And I, he's a super honest guy. And he's like, I only want this one limited edition, 500 copies. You have all the other rights. You keep the movie, TV rights. You keep the audiobook rights. You keep all the other rights. And so I'm thinking, okay, so this is still like in every way that I can imagine, like a fresh novel that can still be shopped, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had it with my former manager, my former agent, this wonderful woman who's super bright, super great at what she does. Just honestly, we had a difference of opinion about it because she perceived it as a reprint and did not think it would sell. And I thought it would because the reception to Marla was off the charts. Publishers Weekly starred review, blurbs from people like Caroline Kepnes and Nick Cutter and all these other people. Just the reader response was mind-blowing. It sold out a month before it even went for sale. And then as we've already talked about, the post buzz, the post-production or post-publication buzz was off the charts. And I was very insistent that this book would, if given the chance, would be very successful for a publisher. And she just didn't see it quite the same way. So I think I coaxed her, and eventually she you know, she did a little bit of investigating into shopping it, but we basically just diverged, and people can disagree, and it's fine. Mm-hmm. All right. We don't have to agree on everything. And so ultimately, honestly, that's kind of what led me to seeking another agent. And so in the meantime, I used to be represented by this guy named Ryan Lewis, who's Josh Mallerman's manager, and he's an executive producer from Bird Box. Ryan is still a great friend, was amazing to me. And he ultimately kind of downsized his company to just focus on Josh's stuff. And so when we were working together, he introduced me to this guy. This will all make sense in a second, but he introduced me to this guy named Patrick White from Lit Entertainment. Lit Entertainment is a production company and a management company. They did The Gorge with Miles Teller and Anya Taylor-Joy. They did all kinds of Free Guy with Ryan Reynolds. They've done all kinds of Raised by Wolves is a show that they did. They're amazing. And so so Patrick and I had been introduced through Ryan. And then when Ryan downsized his company, Ryan was like, I think Patrick will want to work with you. Like, cause I'd been working with both a little bit. And so I talked to Patrick and then Adam Kohlbrenner, who's the principal at Lit Entertainment, the owner of it. And so Adam became my manager, and Patrick and I work together now every day. So my point is this: when I broke it off with my other agent, I was investigating what agent to have next. And I talked to both Ryan and Patrick about, you know, how to go about that. And both of them said, ask the agent, because I had one in mind, this guy named Lane Haymont. And they were like, ask him about Marla. And that can be your litmus test, because that was the whole thing that was kind of a wedge between you and your former agent. Like, you got along in every other way, but you just disagreed about that book. Right. And they're like, if Lane is enthusiastic about Marla, that's going to be a good sign. And if he's not, maybe we should keep looking. So I contacted Lane, and then we had a phone call. And the first thing out of his mouth, he literally said, what the hell's going on with Marla? And because he'd been hearing about it like online, he'd been hearing about it, and all sorts of like horror people had heard about it, like a lot of horror people had heard about it. And I'm like, well, and then I told him what I just told you, only in much more detail. And he's like, well, that's our first action item. Like, we've really, that's got it. And this was in like late 2025 when we started working together. So Lit Entertainment, they also represent Weird Tales for movie and film. So they knew John Harlacker, the editor of Weird Tales, and Lane Haymott knew John Harlacker as well. So there's this kind of rectangulation going on with me and Harlacker and Lane and Lit Entertainment. And so we all kind of like fused together because it just felt like a fit. And Harlacker from Weird Tales read Marla and went nuts for it, and then offered the 3-book deal, and the rest is now what we're seeing now. But it was, I think things, I don't know, this sounds very naive, but I think things kind of happen the way they're supposed to a lot of the time. And that's kind of the way this was supposed to happen, because I think this was where it was supposed to be, because Harlacker at Weird Tales and Blackstone, they just love the book, and they've treated it so marvelously. They've just done such a beautiful job, from the gorgeous hardcover to the audiobook narrators they chose. I could not be happier. So I'd got to be honest, I've been filibustering for so long, I almost forget the original question, but I felt like I should give you some behind the scenes about how this came to pass. And now here we are, and it's finally, but that's why it took so long. It took so long
Right.
because of all those convolutions and weird twists and
Yeah.
turns.
Makes sense. I mean, that is actually super interesting to hear because you hear that about movies and everything, and it's like, oh, these guys have the IP, and then this production company bought it, but they're not doing anything with it, so they're sitting on it, like development hell, as they call it, type of thing. So yeah, so I guess maybe it's not the same term in
The publishing
the publishing industry,
industry,
but it still sounds like there's still a lot of
is
like,
it just distribution hell?
yeah, there's like,
It's definitely, it is. They're both hell. You're right. No, and I think it's very similar in what you talked about. Like movies, you two know, like movies so much more than like most folks do. But it's extraordinary to me that any movie gets made because of all the hurdles that it's got to surmount. You two are just at a festival, right? And just because the movie's there doesn't mean it's going to be this big, wide, beloved
Oh,
hit, right? Like it's still
constantly.
those movies, even though I'm sure a lot of them are amazing, are clawing their way, right, to try to get whatever distribution, to try to get an audience, to try to get all these things. It's so hard, and publishing is really not that different in that way.
That's it. We've seen movies at the festival
Yes.
like a year ago, and they were released this year, or
Yes.
they're going to be released like
Or
somewhere in
maybe
the
they'll get
future.
a small release and maybe they'll fall into the ether and we will never
Yeah.
find them again. And we're disappointed because they're, things that we thoroughly enjoy. So I think, but
Yeah.
you know what? I think this sort of background, to sort of circle back to like everything that you've kind of dealt with in the last few years for this, it's nice to hear about it because it does give maybe some encouragement to people who are writing, who are starting, who are hoping potentially to be published, or indie authors who are looking for like a trad publication of some sort, to pick up and to distribute their work, and to know that there are still possibilities to do this, and there is a way to to get your stories out there and still be able to do that. It's just nice to be able to say to people like, don't think that you can't do it. Don't think that you can't write that. Don't think that you can't get it out to an audience.
Yeah. And something else too, I would say, I agree with everything you just said, was amazing. I think too, what's become apparent to me is that, there can be changes in business, and it doesn't have to be hostile. It doesn't mean that there are any villains. Like, I just mentioned two changes. Like Ryan and I, I changed movie managers, and we are still friends, and nobody did anything wrong. He was extraordinary to me. He did so much for me, and I just will always value him. And then my old agent, like, she didn't do anything wrong. She's, like I said, she's really good at what she does, and she treated me really, really well. We just disagreed about one book. And that happens sometimes. And sometimes it pays to kind of stick that situation out. Sometimes it pays to change. Every situation is different. This was just a situation where I was pretty passionate. Again, there were never raised voices, never anything like that. I just felt in my heart that there needed to be a change, and I feel good about where things have gone.
I mean, it sounds like it's been exactly to your point, the right move, and things have happened for a reason that way, which is great.
Yes.
So out of curiosity, because it has been 4 years since you initially had the release, out of curiosity, were there any changes to the text, or are what people are getting now the exact same Marla that they got in 2022?
Yeah, it is almost the exact same. Weird Tales put it in Blackstone, put it through the normal editorial process that they would use for a new book. And so it got a lot of attention. And of course, Harlacker edited it, and then it had the line edit and all the other things. And so there are little minor alterations here and there. And the thing is, like, I bet a lot of people feel this way who create things. Like, you're never really done, right? You just run out of time. And so you can always go back and tinker and change. Mm-hmm. And there are a few little things that I loved the book in 2022, but there are a few little things over the years. I'm like, you know, if that does come back out, I'd like to tweak this, but I'd say probably it's 98% the same as it was. Yeah.
Okay.
Changes. Mostly I would notice, mostly like if somebody read it in 22, read it now, I don't even know if they'd notice.
Okay. Okay. So largely the same thing. Well, it's good to know for people who did read the initial release, they're not getting an entirely different story.
So. Right. 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 Exactly. Yeah.
Is there any additions added to the hardcover book?
Yes, there is a vital edition. And so it's in the hardcover edition and in the audiobook, which I didn't even know until like Wednesday, the day after it released. So it is Harlacker wanted because he wanted to do something special with the hardcover edition. And boy, oh boy, did they. I didn't know any of this terminology. I knew what foil was, but there are foil letters on the hardcover, sprayed edges, which I guess I knew. I just didn't know that's what they were called. And there's like interior art, like so much interior art that's just beautiful. And then Harlacker wanted me to write a special piece. And the initial idea was to put it on Weird Tales' website. They were going to have like a firewall, like a paywalled part of their website where I put this story on there. And if you pre-ordered it, you're going to get it. But we ultimately decided that this would be the perfect thing to put with a hardcover. So that's what we ultimately did. And I wrote and the thing was, he did too. It wasn't just a cash grab, but I really wanted it, and he wanted it to be additive. Like, we wanted it to be like an actual important piece of the mythos, the Marlaverse, as I think of it. And so I wrote it's like a 10 or 11,000 word novelette prequel called Moonflowers that takes place. So on I think it's the second page of Marla, you get this little paragraph about like why she's an urban legend. And it talks about something that happens on Halloween night, happened 11 years ago. So this story, Moonflowers, is about what happened 11 years ago. And then the investigator, the private detective who took on the case. And you mentioned in the outset, the potential adaptation of Marla for streaming. So that woman, I can't name her yet, but she's going to be the showrunner. She is just an absolutely brilliant, amazing, awesome human being. I love her. But she and I kind of incubated this together to where we could seed something for the second season of the series. So that's what we did. So this is not only a prequel to the book that everybody gets, but if there is a series, this character introduced is going to be a major part of the series in the second season. So super fun and super cool.
Oh, that's fun. That's like a lore drop that you get from the book. So it's fun because it's for the readers, you know, to kind of be aware, oh, hey, perhaps down the line, this is something that you'll see.
100%. 100%. Yeah.
Did you add that novelette with the series in mind, or was it just for like an additive thing for the book itself?
I've been thinking about the sequel of Marla, like as a novel, ever since I wrote the first book. And so the character had been in my head all along. But when Harlacker mentioned doing a short story, and I think he was thinking like 3,000-4,000 words, but I couldn't come up with anything. Cause again, I want it to really be essential, yet not something that you had to have to understand the novel. Right. Mm-hmm. I did because I listen, I love superhero movies, I love Marvel movies, but it does feel kind of like you have to do homework now. Sometimes before Doomsday. Oh, I saw this article about all the things you're supposed to watch before Doomsday. I'm like, geez, I'm a fan. And even I haven't seen all those things. I haven't seen the Loki TV series. I haven't seen Wakanda Forever yet, which I plan to. Mm-hmm. But like, I didn't want to make it like that for readers of Marla. I didn't want them to think, oh, shoot, do I have to read this beforehand? So, you know, so that posed kind of a quandary for me. So I wanted something to be additive. I didn't want to put more burden on the reader. So the showrunner and I, she and I were talking, and as we talked, I talked about this character that I would like to be in the second book, and she found that intriguing enough that that kind of merged with a lot of the, because what she's done, she's really gotten me to think about like the origins of the story and like the lore around the story, because she really wants to like know everything about King's Branch, about this town. She wants to know everything about these characters in the past. And so it's gotten me to think. One thing we've done that's so fun, like we text and talk on the daily, but she and I, she created a Pinterest board where she and I, like for the Marla series, we have all these images and stuff. So it was in that Pinterest board, the moonflowers are in Marla, the book. So it's like this smell, the character smell, and they're kind of a symbol for Marla's arrival. Talking to the showrunner, she and I kind of came up with this idea to include that character. So that's kind of how it all came together. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's very cool.
I'm really looking forward to this. I just love the idea that there's like an entire mythos about the town itself. It's very like Widow's Bay is the most recent thing that comes to mind. That makes me, oh, yay.
Nice. I love Widow's Bay. Awesome.
It's so good.
It's like so good.
It was fantastic. I love it so much.
Oh my gosh, it's such a marvelous show. I just love it so much. It's one of those things where, you know, I think I started to love it as everybody was discovering. I wasn't like one of the first ones to discover it. Mm-hmm. So maybe I sound like a bandwagon person, but it is just so stinking funny and so scary. And I don't know that I've ever seen anything do those two things that well.
It is so good. I want Patricia to exist so that she can be my best friend forever. She's fabulous.
I love her. I love her. And Tom Loftus makes me laugh. Is that Matthew Reese? Is that his name?
I don't know if I've ever seen a better comedic actor in my entire life. His physical comedy is so good.
The scene with the painting, made my poor daughter, Juliet, who's starting Purdue this week. She's starting college this week. She's my horror buddy, and we watch everything together, horror-wise. But I made her, she was like, Dad, seriously? As I rewound that scene like seven times, I'm like, but look how funny it is. And it keeps getting worse and worse and worse. Oh my gosh, that show is brilliant. And by the way, I saw a reel with Matthew, and he said that made the stunt people angry because they told him not to do that because the real painting was really heavy. And they said, look, don't fall. And he's like, but he wanted to go for it. So he did. And thank goodness he did because this is perfect.
So good. Great. But I love that because it's this wonderful sort of, you know, it has that feel that you get from a lot of horror media, whether it's books or, you know, film or television or whatever the case may be, that are set in a particular town. There's something about in the horror genre where developing the lore of the town in which the horror is occurring, like in a, you know, dairy sort of way or things like that, right? Like in a Stephen King kind of way,
Castle Rock.
Yes, exactly. Like, I think it just makes the story and the characters that much more impactful. So it's really cool that it's like that kind of, you know, development. And through something, I can only imagine through something like a TV series, it gives you so much bandwidth to be able to expand on things and do that, which is really cool as well.
I so agree. And you mentioned Castle Rock, Derry and Castle Rock. Yeah. Those places feel so lived in. They feel so vivid and real. Yes. And like when you read those books or watch any shows associated with those, you feel like you're there. You feel like you're coming home. It's an amazing thing. I could not agree more.
That's great.
That's awesome. Is there, since we're talking about the current development of the series, is there anything that you were like really protected of that you didn't want to change too much?
No.
If it's gone that far, I don't know.
Yeah, so no, we're still pretty early stages here. We're gonna have a we've had a lot of Zooms. We're gonna have another Zoom coming up in about a week and a half. And so the thing is the showrunner, she is working on another show. She's freaking a rock star. So she's so it's a good delay. It's a delay because she's doing something really amazing already. And so that makes her schedule pretty tight. But when, when she has a gap, that's hopefully when this is going to really kind of take root a little more. But I got to tell you, so I have several things in. I just got a text as we were talking from the there's a screenwriter adapting Veil. You all know about Veil. And so I've got several things with people attached. There's one, so there's a director for up this guy attached, this amazing director. He was at the same film festival you were. I'll tell you all who it was later. He's directing, hopefully going to direct something else that I've done. But I've got this other yet another short story. It's like a novelette that's being turned into a screenplay right now. And that screenwriter, she asked me this kind of that question that you just asked me. She said, "How," she said, "that I know you have a lot of things in the process of adaptation, but you, it's because I'm new to this. Like honestly, I haven't had a Bird Box yet. I haven't, of course, nobody has a Bird Box. That's a rarity. Why do I have this? Why did I use that one? Why did I use the most successful Netflix movie of all time? Most people never have anything make it to the screen in any way, right? So I'm still like a novice in that area, and so I'm not experienced in that area, and I'm learning." But she said to me, she because she was feeling me out, this woman, she said, "A lot of writers can have difficulty with the adaptation process." She says, "How do you feel about it?" She said, "Because it can be kind of violent, like breaking a story from one medium to another can be kind of a violent process." And my answer to her was, "Let's let the ultra violence begin. Like break it as much as you want. Like rip it apart, put it back together in whatever Frankensteinian way you want." And I mean it because I teach and I've taught I'm a novice in some ways with film, but in another way I've taught film lit for 25 years. So for a quarter century, one of the things I've learned about is adaptation. And you've heard stories, authors can be so precious about their work. And I get it, believe me. It's our baby. We've created these people out of thin air. We're molding the clay. I understand why people are very particular about what they want. All I can do is speak for me. For me, there's so many books out there and so many authors. If somebody is going to honor me by choosing my book to adapt, I just feel like all I feel is appreciation. And so for me, like that, I was just talking about the Veil, the guy who's adapting Veil into a screenplay, he's changed multiple things. And each time, honestly, I get excited because that makes me feel like we're one step closer to, getting this thing made. Because everything has to be, even so, like two story, like Rosemary's Baby and No Country for Old Men. Those are two adaptations that are really, really faithful to the source material, but even those changed, right? And so I think it's just a matter of having, like, for me, the healthiest mindset possible, which is to understand that, it's an honor. I'm excited. They're going, this cannot be theirs unless they commit that violence, right? If they don't change anything, it's still kind of mine. And I'm not the screenwriter, I'm not the director, I'm not the showrunner. And I just have to have the ability to let that go a little bit. And what's awesome too, what's making that a lot easier is that they're really involving me. Is that they are like, so far, like in all these cases with all these different people attached, they're really involving me. Now that could just be luck. It could be partially that they sense that I'm not going to be a backseat driver. In fact, that was the analogy. Like, because I said, I'm sure some writers are backseat drivers telling you which way to turn. I said, I'm the person in the back with my feet kicked up, just grinning and just enjoying the ride. Because it's true. That's how I am. That's how in Mallarmin with Bird Box, he tells a story about when Netflix came in, they had this big meeting and they had all these changes in mind. And Josh said he could read their body language. He could read their faces. They were really worried about what he was going to say. And they said, this is what we want to do. This. And then they all just kind of held their breath. And Josh is like, that sounds amazing. Let's do it. And they were all just like astonished. But to me, that makes total sense. To me, I'm like, yeah, why wouldn't you just be excited? Because these people, because that's one more thing. I'm sorry to, again, give you all these long answers. But Josh told me a long time ago, because when Ryan was shopping my work, there was one time, there were a few times when it was really close, like on different projects to getting optioned or made. And Josh said, look, you know, because I was never mad, but I was disappointed when stuff wouldn't happen. And Josh was like, he said, Jonathan, they're not saying, I don't like your book. They're not saying, I don't want to work with you. All they're saying is, I don't want to devote the next 2 years of my life to this project because I have other things I also want to work on. And that's not just being nice. That's true. It's true. Like when people commit to making a movie or a series, they're devoting a substantial chunk of their time, their life, away from their families, their energy. So to me, it's like the ultimate compliment that they would even think about adapting my work.
I mean, I think that's a really healthy attitude to have about it. Also, I love that. I feel like, you know, you were lucky, you're fortunate enough to have a very close friend who has been through this already now, like multiple times. So it's great because you're able to get that advice. Side note, I'm really excited for Other Mommy when it comes out in October. But can you please tell Josh that I wish that they had kept the title of the book as the title of the film?
That's an example of what we're talking about. Because, okay, so I hope I'm not speaking out of turn here, but Incidents Around the House is an extraordinary title. There was some talk in the publishing part where that might change. And Josh is, you know, he's a very easygoing guy, very easy to get along with. And he and I talked about that. And while that debate was going on, and you know, because there are other things that, because you've heard, obviously, choose your battles, right? You got to figure out what hill to die on. And Josh, ultimately, he's respectful to everybody in the process. But that was a kid, and I'm sure ultimately, maybe he would have acquiesced. But that was a place where he was very vocal in his opinion. And I was vocal too with him, because I'm like, that title, it reminds me of, there's a title by Henry James called, I think it's called The Elegance of Certain Old Clothes. Mm-hmm. Like there's certain titles with like a mystique to them. Certain titles with this indefinable just kind of beauty and elegance. And Incidents Around the House has that elegance. It's just a beautiful, because it's kind of mundane. It's kind of just simple. Yeah. But in that, you can just let your imagination run rampant. And so thankfully, they kept that title for the book. When it came time for the movie, you know, again, there's like an added layer of, I think, flexibility that you had to have. And I think Josh was just very flexible about that. I wish they would have kept the title too. Yeah. But I will say, the moment I heard, I think it's Rob Savage as the director, the moment I heard that's who was doing it, because Host, I think he directed Host, one of my all-time favorite horror movies, top five of all time, top five scariest. The moment I heard that name, I'm like, dude, you know, and he was like, and Josh was so excited too. We were both like, yeah, whatever they do is going to be good, right? Whatever they do, you're in good hands. And that was even before Jessica Chastain was part of this, right? When we knew Rob Savage, it was like, okay, this is going to be, and then the trailer, I know you,
oh my sure God.
You saw, woo! It's going to be killer. It's going to be amazing.
I think that it was the perfect level of additional hype and marketing for the film for the trailer to have played before The Odyssey and for everybody to have freaked out about going to a non-horror film and seeing this trailer, which is extremely disconcerting and kind of terrifying to see because of even what you see in the trailer, let alone what the movie is about.
You know, about that, if you can we like one more little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. Okay.
So here's how I heard about that. I didn't know, I was hyped for The Odyssey, and obviously I'm hyped for Other Mommy, but I didn't know they were going to do that. I didn't know that was going to show. And so here's how I found out about it. When The Odyssey came out, people online were like, there are people who are pissed.
Oh yeah.
People who are mad, who are not horror people. They're like, I should not have been subjected to that. I'm thinking, woo, this must be amazing. This must be the best teaser trailer or whatever ever for these people to be so angry. And so when my family, I bought IMAX tickets for my family to go see it. And we weren't hyped. I mean, yeah, we were hyped for the Odyssey because we love Christopher Nolan and we love all everything about it. We were most hyped about the trailer. So we got there like a half hour early and we're all sitting there. And I think it was at AMC theaters where that trailer played. Ours, I didn't realize it's a different like company. They didn't show it.
No.
And like, so, and then, like every time they got ready to show a trailer, like my horror loving daughter, she'd grab my arm. She'd be like, dad. I'm like, yeah, here we go. And then we were like seeing something else. And then something else. Oh. And then they got through like six trailers and it didn't show. And everybody's looking at me like, dude, you said it was going to be, I'm like, and I thought it was going to be on here. I was told that it was going to be on here. Anyway, it was a disappointment, but then I went
home
and watched.
They showed it at ours. So
did they really?
Yeah, they absolutely did. Cineplex so here lucky. In Canada showed it at our theater. So I think everybody was pretty freaked out about that. And I would argue that anybody who was angry is a little bit absurd because there are some pretty genuinely horrific moments in the Odyssey as well. In certain ways that things are filmed and framed and stuff like that, you know, like the Cyclops and like a few of the other sequences. So really, I mean, how angry could you be?
I know,
you're
right?
Basically seeing something very dark immediately after seeing the trailer. Who cares? You're already in the right mood.
The Circe stuff, that's horror. That's horrific.
Oh, yeah.
Scary. Yeah.
My God.
Very much. So really, maybe people weren't too happy with that either. I don't know.
Well, I don't know where we are anymore.
No,
we'll get there.
I've derailed us. I have no responsibility.
It's awesome.
I reach from the back seat, grab the wheel, and steer this off the road.
It's perfect. It's good. You know what? I'm going to jump into more of the adaptation side of things because we're talking about movies and stuff. Since there is different perspectives and different characters from whom the story is told, and like you mentioned at the beginning, and you also, Megan, mentioned at the beginning that it could be like an unreliable narrator type of thing.
Yeah.
From the book and maybe into what's happening with the adaptation right now, which one do you think is like the hardest to keep honest, I guess,
like or a perspective?
Of those characters. I don't know if that makes sense. You know what I mean?
No, it absolutely makes sense. No, it absolutely does. It's interesting. I'm just actually thinking about it. I'm thinking about the different perspectives in the book because you got the three primary ones and then you go into some other characters. You know what? I think in a weird way, that's going to be an easier process. I mean, the series won't be easy, of course, like any series is involved. But like Vale, for instance, the guy who's adapting that's a first person narrative all the way through one POV. And so, which is, I guess, simpler, but at the same time, it's difficult to, you know, you've got to kind of figure out if you ever want to diverge from his story, right? Because that's not in the book. So you've got to kind of create that. In Marla, it even though it's all third person limited to this person in this scene, this person in this scene, that alone makes it a little more omniscient, with that, which I think also makes it a little more cinematic. So we are going to be able to follow this character. We are going to be, so I guess for me, it'll be all about how that's going to be edited. Right. Okay. So where we're going to cut from this character to that character. And I, you know what I think might be the most challenging to do would be the younger POV, the Dylan POV, because Dylan Ellison's 21. And so he's interacting with young people. And it's interesting because Marla, it's like, because it's a multi-generational story. You know, you've got Carl and Annie who are kind of the same age, and then Dylan is a younger age. And so it's going to be interesting to see how they thread that needle to make it, because you know what show did this really well? Actually, you know what? We were talking about Widow's Bay. When they cut away to Tom Loftus' son, they do a good job with those teenage scenes.
Sure.
They do. And the one I was going to reference was Stranger Things. But you've got really three kind of age groups in that one, and they do a really good job. But, you know, because you want it to be the same show, but then you also want them to have their own flavor. And so I guess that balancing act would be the hardest part, because you don't want it to all of a sudden become Outer Banks or whatever. Nothing against that show.
No, but
nothing
it's true.
But this isn't Marla, right? That's not Marla, even though there's, you know, there's teenage drinking and parties and all that stuff. It's sure. not that vibe, right? It's a different kind of thing. So I think as long as they can make those different age groups coalesce, I think that might be the biggest challenge.
True. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Would you say that's why Marla is a TV show that needed like multiple episodes as opposed to the other ones or not? Because you need to have that
film
space.
Adaptations, because we know that's it. Like there, you've had that's it a few works like Bale and things picked up as well. So
that's super interesting. Yeah, Patrick and I. Patrick's my main collaborator at Lit Entertainment, and we talk a lot about. And I ask him all the time. I'm like, so this book, what do you think it is? Not a movie, or do you think it's a feature or a series? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so his answer will be sometimes feature, sometimes series, sometimes both, depending. And I think that that's a really fascinating question, because I think that there are some things that really are tailor-made for features. And I think that, you know, part of that is the size of the cast, maybe, and maybe the timeline. Right? How condensed it is. I think that's another part of whether it goes feature or series. I think with Marla, I think what made that so interesting is a series, because Patrick, back when I was working with Ryan, this was back in like 2024 before the agent switch. Mm-hmm. How I met, this is wild. So Ryan introduced me to Patrick. Patrick, he'd read Marla. Patrick had done a 35-page treatment of Marla, like synopsized the whole thing. Wow. He'd like created a pitch for it, and he called it The Outsider Meets Mayor of Easttown. So he always saw it as a series, but I think the reason why was because he just felt that like there was something rich about mm-hmm. it. Kind of what we talked about earlier with Derry and Castle Rock. Because like, look now, you got Welcome to Derry. It chapters 1 and 2, right? Mm-hmm. Together, even though it was a movie, it was like over five hours, right? Oh, yeah. And then you got Welcome to Derry as a series. So I think Derry is this really rich tapestry that kind of begs for a longer treatment. And I think that's kind of what King's Branch is like in Marla. Like it's, mm-hmm. you could do it as a feature. Initially, Ryan and I thought of it as a feature, to be honest with you, back when Ryan was representing me. It kind of moved toward the series when I changed movie management. And Patrick and Adam Kohlbrenner at Lit Entertainment, they kind of, I think, saw it more as a series. Not that it was wrong or right. I think both would work. In fact, there was a lot of interest in the feature version of Marla too, mm-hmm. but I think that they just felt that that it needed like a longer more room to breathe, right?
Yeah.
That's what's cool about a series. You really get to know the characters. You really get to live with them for a while. Reacher, totally off script, totally different genre, but I'm really enjoying Reacher right now.
We started watching it just recently, the latest season.
I love it.
We did what, two episodes so far? It's I like it. You know what I mean? We were talking about yesterday. Reacher's the kind of character that you can just plop anywhere and he's going to find some fucked up shit to do. You know?
I think Alan Ritchson is like stupidly charming as this character. Yeah. I feel like you could just make 5,000 seasons of it and people would be like, okay, regardless of the situation or the actual plot.
I agree. I love that guy.
Yeah.
I watch Reacher because of... A neighbor recommended it, but I saw some Instagram. It sounds like I'm addicted to Instagram reels, but I saw some reels with Alan Ritchson talking, and I just really like dug his vibe, and I respect what he stands for. Yeah. I'll say that too. I just think that he is a good, solid dude, and I really appreciate that. I really like people who, I mean, I don't know, it makes me sound like I'm in my own little echo chamber, but I just, you know, it's nice when you feel people care. It's nice when you feel people are genuine. And that's how I feel about him. I feel like he and I could like have a lunch together and just hang out and he'd be cool. And so those combinations got me to the show, and I freaking love it. And like you're saying, like, it's fun to spend time with Reacher. It's fun to spend time, you know, watching that all unfold. And I agree. I would watch him. I'd watch that character in Spain. I'd watch that character in Japan. I'd watch that character in the Arctic Circle. It doesn't matter. It's Reacher.
Yeah.
He's just awesome. And by the way, he's very different. Like, that's a character. Like, he's acting. Because, you know, I think a lot of action stars are kind of themselves. That's not how he talks or acts. Like, that's very much a character. Dude's a good actor.
Yeah.
He was. I liked him in War Machine as well. I don't know if you saw that one on Netflix.
I haven't seen it. Is it good?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not. It's like a sci-fi action, so it's very different from Reacher and everything. But he was good in it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's an
yeah.
easy time.
I need to. Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? So speaking of like genuine and being genuine to the character and to the adaptation and everything, from what you said, it feels like, at least to me, you don't want, and you, I mean, you and everyone don't want Marla to become the Dark Tower movie. You know what I mean? Like you need the wow. space for it. I'm sorry. I'm always going to egg on that.
I know
movie
you're so funny. It's like you're stuck on it.
I love
forever.
That series and they just butchered it and I can't.
It's fine. It'll, you know what? The series will get there eventually. Mike Flanagan will get there eventually.
Yeah, I know.
I hope so. I've never seen the Dark Tower movie.
Don't.
It's terrible. It. Really bad.
Is it really bad?
Well, I mean, you know the books, right? There's like, what, 8 of them?
Seven.
The books are part. The books are part of me. I love the book. Yeah.
Same. And they did a movie for an hour and a half. Like that is just literally impossible. You cannot condense 8 books into an hour and a half movie.
Not at all. It, I will say from the perspective of someone who's never read, I've read a lot of Stephen King, but I have not read the Dark Tower series. Going into it, it is so incredibly confusing that we watched it together and Arthur had to like explain to me regularly why something was happening because I was like, what? What's going on? I don't understand why this story is even happening because it's so condensed that they've cut out, you know, I think the majority of all of the reason as to what the background is and why this is happening and everything and Midworld and all this stuff that you're like, I don't even know what this is. So
my goodness. And that's so sad too. Cause the leads are Idris Elba
excellent.
And Matthew McConaughey, excellent. Right? Like it was teed up for something maybe really awesome, but yeah, that's sad. It's very sad. Cause like you are saying the series next level. I just love those books. So I'm really hoping Flanagan gets to it. I'm hoping that, and I know he would if he could. It's like, it's, you know, people above his pay grade, even he's got to work with and figure out, and hopefully it'll happen.
Yeah. It's the whole development hell we're talking about as well. God knows who has the IP now because they did a movie. So someone owns it, right?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure.
That's it. Gosh. All right. I feel like we can talk to you all day, but also I want to be conscious of your time. Yeah. I just have one last question. So you have your writing books. You are being involved in the adaptations of some of your novels. You also are a school teacher that just had a semester start. Mm-hmm. How do you do it? When do you have the time? Do you live 30 hours in a day? Like how does this happen?
That's very kind of you. A couple things. One is like there's a lot of writing advice out there. And one piece of writing advice I hear by people I love and respect, they say you have to write every day. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. And I know where they're coming from. I disagree. I think you write when you can, you know, because not all of us can write every day. I cannot write every day. Yeah, mm-hmm. I could ignore my wife and kids. Sure, I could choose to do that, but I couldn't live with myself. And mm-hmm. and honestly, what's the point? Like, what's the point of writing, of living in this fictional world when the real world is passing me by? So I always try to keep my priorities, like family number one, teaching second, writing third. It doesn't mean that writing is less important to me, say, than teaching. But I feel like if I take a couple weeks off writing, nobody is harmed.
Right.
The voices in my head are a little louder and more insistent and they're clamoring to come out on the page. But if I ignore 2 weeks of teaching, then my students are affected and I have a responsibility to them to do my best by them. Mm-hmm. And so, I try to keep my priorities straight and I write when I can. And that's just it. Like in the summer, this summer, we don't have to go too deeply into this, but my mom passed away in April and I needed writing this summer more than ever for like therapeutic reasons.
Sorry
like
to family, hear that.
Yeah, thank you. My family was my life buoy and then writing. But I normally write like 140, 150,000 words in the summer. So I write like wild in the summer. I wrote 210,000 words this summer.
Wow.
And so I'm as productive as I can possibly be when I can write. I don't write every day because I just can't because I teach and stuff.
Yeah.
Someday I'll make that transition to full-time writer. But while I'm teaching, I want to give it my all. So, yeah. And I think the other thing, too, is there's like one thing that suffered, honestly, is friendships. I've not been a good friend to my friends because I just don't have time to do stuff with them. So I never go out. I'm never like on the golf course. I'm never going out for dinner with my friends like I probably should on occasion. So, you know, maybe as my kids grow up, I can get some, you know, I can reclaim some time in that direction. But I just basically do those three things and that's it. So that's how I make those three things work. But I don't have a very, I don't have a glamorous life. I'm not like a man of mystery that I disappear and do all these wild things. I'm very predictable. Like, you know, that we have this app called Life360. It's like the simplest. So it's like I live 4 blocks from school. So it's like it moves to school, back to home, and that's occasionally to the gas station to get a slushie with my daughter. I have the most predictable, simple life that anybody could have, but you know.
Hey, sometimes, you know, simple is good. That's what's needed, and why not?
Honestly, there's enough chaos in the world
I
as it is.
know.
So.
Jeez, seriously. You know what? You answered my follow-up question if you were ever planning to
To
transition.
transition into
Yeah,
full-time
so
writing, yeah.
that makes sense.
Yeah. My youngest is a sophomore in high school. And so and there's something very special about getting to teach where your kids go to school. And I had my other two kids, I had them in four different classes, two in eighth grade, two in their senior year. And so hopefully with my daughter, my youngest, I'll get to do the same thing with her. And then after that, we'll see. But I just, as long as I have the opportunity to be in the building with her, I want
Yeah.
to do that. And then you never know. Yeah.
Yeah, you never know.
Just side note, you don't look old enough to have kids in college.
Well, thank you. I thank you. I appreciate it.
Was bothering me.
I feel very much my age a lot of the time. A good bit of the time I feel that. Yeah.
Okay,
Goodness.
shall
Yeah.
we play a game
Yes.
to
So we
finish
wanted
everything?
to wrap this up with a little game for you.
Yeah.
So you will have another job to take on just for a little while. So the little game is going to be this way. So you have to so here's the context, right? You are building a small town from scratch. So
Okay.
you are the main guy. So you have to staff the town. You have to staff the town for five different jobs from with horror characters from any movie or book.
That's so fun. Oh my gosh.
There you
Okay, okay. I don't know
go.
if I can do it, but it sounds really fun.
Whatever comes to
We'll
you first
try.
to mind.
Yeah.
So I'll give you a position, and you can give me a character, a horror character who would take on this position in the town.
Yeah.
And if you have a reason for it, that would be great.
Okay.
So we'll start with kind of like, I guess, the main dude of the town, a
Wow.
sheriff.
Sheriff.
Yeah, who of the horror characters would be a sheriff, movie or book?
I'd pick Stu Redman from The Stand. A lot of this is probably going
Ooh.
to be Stephen King oriented
Ooh.
because
That's
I
such
love
a good
King.
choice.
And yeah, because East Texas is somebody who's got the toughness to do that job, to stand up and even the physicality sometimes necessary for the job, but he's certainly not out there cruising for trouble. You know, he would be there to protect and serve actually the way a sheriff should.
True. And we probably would be just as well.
True. Yeah.
Yeah, he would be
Yeah.
just above all, right? I agree.
Sure. All right. Perfect. So we have Sheriff as
Stu
Stu
Redman.
Redman. Now we need someone to patch people up. So a town doctor.
That's a good one, man. I'm gonna say, I'm gonna say here, doesn't I feel like Beverly Marsh might be good at that because she's somebody who's had physical and certainly emotional trauma. And I think that she would perform that job with firmness, but also tenderness. And I think that she would be very comforting. And also, and I tell you what, you know, another thing that a doctor has to have is composure. She in it, there are several times when chaos is erupting around and she kind of steps up. And so I could see her doing that. Kind of like my daughter who's going to nursing, Juliet. Yeah, she's got that composure piece, which is really kind of rare and awesome. I think Bev has that.
Interesting. Okay.
That's an
Wow. That's
interesting
a cool
choice. She could
choice.
also be the town therapist, honestly, with everything that
Yeah,
she's dealt
seriously.
with.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Perfect. All right. So now we have a school teacher, and you can't choose yourself.
This is so weird.
Yeah,
Oh Oh, a school teacher. If I went out of horror, I'd probably choose Ryan Gosling's Ryland Grace from Project Hail Mary. But
Ooh,
yes, I'm
yes.
not. I'm not gonna take us out of the horror world because
Okay.
we've got to. Teacher-wise, it would have to be somebody dynamic, somebody who is interesting. I guess Indiana Jones would be another great one. Because I love all the scenes where he's a professor. What a, I mean, that would be the coolest thing to have in as your
Oh, yeah.
teacher. But let's see, staying with horror, I would choose, okay, how about this? You mentioned this character, and this character, she loves mystery. Patricia from Widow's Bay.
Nice.
Because here's when I knew Widow's Bay was going to be an amazing show. It was because of one of her lines. In the opening episode, Tom Loftus, the mayor, says to her, "I need you." I think he says, "I need you to show the travel writer around the island." And Patricia says, "What are you asking me to do?" And Tom goes, "What the hell do you think I'm asking you to do? Right? What are you talking about?" Because she's like, her mind is going to all these places that would
There's
occur in
something
a novel,
else.
right? And I love, she's so. And she drives around with books, right? Doesn't she drive the bookmobile?
Yes.
So Patricia is, she's literary, she's imaginative, she's well read, she's interesting, she's earnest, she's a good storyteller. I think she would be an awesome teacher. I think she would be killer.
She's also great under pressure because she has an entire episode where she's running away from someone trying to murder
Oh my
her.
God, yeah.
So, yeah.
What a great episode.
It's my
Oh, you're
favorite
gonna
episode.
make
I
me
think it might be
rewatch.
my favorite episode of the show. It's so
That's an
good.
amazing episode.
I don't,
When
I
she
feel like,
go
okay, it's a bonus, but I feel like the mayor would probably be Tom. I know it's more of like a bonus person in the town, but I
it would
wouldn't be
still be a
upset.
good job.
I love Tom Loftus.
He's so great. Okay, do you want to pick one of these two? Or like that they would be the same person. That's
No,
what
yeah,
I would
no,
do.
it's one.
Okay, fine.
It's the second one. Pick the second one.
Okay. So next on the list would be a person to be the funeral director.
Okay, the funeral director. Okay, so I could just be literal here and choose somebody who's comforting and all that. But what if we make this like a little eerier to give the town some flavor? What if two people who come to mind? One is Wick, Stephen Root from Widow's Bay, because he's a heck of a character. But what about, isn't his name Clancy Brown? The actor who's it, the movie is called The Mortuary Collection.
Oh
And I
my
think,
God, yes.
and he actually plays the mortician, I think,
Yes.
right?
Yep.
He's amazing in everything he's in. Like he was in Shawshank Redemption. He's in all this.
Yeah.
He's always amazing and always like, you all know who it is. I don't think many people would know who that is, but he is an amazing actor. So he in Mortuary Collection, an anthology film, he just killed it, no pun intended, as that character. I would love for him. He would give the town so much flavor, that bent of the macabre. That would be awesome.
I am so happy that you plugged that because it's one of my favorite horror anthologies of
You
all
love
time.
it.
I adore
Oh,
that
you
film.
like that? You help me
It's
both.
perfect from start to finish. I love it so much.
Please watch the Mortuary Collection, people.
Yeah,
It is
everybody should watch the
phenomenal.
Mortuary
Yeah.
Collection if you haven't.
So
It's
good.
so
Because people,
good.
there are a lot of good ones. People talk about Trick or Treat and they talk about these other
100%, yeah.
anthologies, which are great, but Mortuary Collection is so slept on. So good.
It is. It's so underrated. I feel like I never hear anyone talk about it, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah, agreed.
Definitely.
And the last one.
Yes. So, okay. So the last one, we have to preface it for a question for you specifically with the people that we currently have. We have the sheriff, who is
Stu.
Stu. I'm not good with memory stuff.
Nope.
We have the town doctor,
Bev from
Bev. Yes.
It.
We have the school teacher, who's Patricia.
Patricia from Widow's
Yes.
Bay, yes.
And we have the funeral director,
Yes. Who is the mortician from
mortician. Right. So
Mortuary
we have
Collection,
all
yes.
these characters.
Yes.
You specifically, Jonathan, would you live in this town?
I tell you what, you are, is it okay to say you all are about ready to move?
Yeah,
Yeah.
we're
Oh,
definitely getting there.
yeah.
Because I don't want people to stalk you or
That's
whatever.
fine.
Talk about the real horror of things
Yeah, well,
is
okay, so
buying property.
dude, okay, if here's a plan for abolishing all crime in the world. If the sentence for a crime would be that you have to move, all crime would cease.
Oh yeah.
That's how difficult it is. All the things that go along with the move. It's so, even if you just move one block, it's so difficult and laborious and hard in every way. All the little things that we don't think about. And so my answer to you, first of all, is I would not if I have to move.
Okay.
Because it's such a pain in the neck. It's brutal. Now, if you took the move out of it and I could like teleport my family and I there, then yes. And my house and all and my animals and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And all the annoyances of having to move. Yes, I would live in that town because I think that'd be a cool place.
Okay.
Okay. So nice. Then following that.
Yes. As, the last character.
Yeah, the last choice that you would make, who would you choose to be your neighbor? The person who lives right next door to you.
Ooh, wow. Okay. So I think the neighbor would be somebody here. It's kind of like, this is part of why I proposed to my wife, because she is fun. She's just fun. And I'm like an extrovert introvert. Like, she does all this Myers-Briggs and she can never figure out what I am. Because in some situations, I am so reserved and silent. In other situations, I can't shut up, like with you all. You bring it out of me. But with when I'm with her, I just know it'll always be fun. It'll always be interesting. And she'll always like have something to talk about and laugh about, which is great. That's not the only reason I chose her. But that was one of the reasons why. I just felt like as a couple, we would age well because she would always just bring life into our world and our relationship. So I feel like a neighbor would also do that. Mm-hmm. I feel like a neighbor would be sort of entertaining, but would also be there to help. So a neighbor, I think, would be great. Actually, there are two people that come to mind. We're going to stay in the Stephen King verse, you know, that whole world. I think Richie Tozier would be hilarious. But I also think Eddie Kasprak would be amazing from It. But I also think Eddie from The Dark Tower would be awesome because he is stinking. What's his last name? I've totally drawn a blank.
I read them so long ago, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, Eddie. And I'm listening to the audiobook of part four as we speak. I'm going to hate myself for this later on. Anyway, he is just
Eddie Dean.
Eddie Dean! Oh my gosh. Thank you so much. Thank you. So Eddie Dean, obviously he's on the other side, hopefully, of all his problems. But Eddie Dean is so funny and entertaining. But also, like, when it comes time to remember the face of your father, he will stand by your side through everything. He will. And I love that about Eddie. I love that about that whole cast. Oi included. I love Oi. Hopefully Oi could be his pet or my pet.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
Yeah, package deal right there, because I love Oi. Yeah, but that boy, you've got me excited about this whole town. I'm excited about my block, about the town. I might actually spend time with friends if I lived in that town.
Right? That sounds like a cool place to live.
Yeah, I feel like you'd always kind of want to be out and, you know, spending time with
people. I mean, just for Patricia alone. Just for Patricia. Yeah. And isn't it in the episode you're talking about? Isn't that where she goes so that she kind of barges into the party of all the women?
Yeah, she confronts the mean girls from high school and then she tases. I feel like I should have prefaced this entire episode with a spoiler warning for Widow's Bay. Sorry.
I'll tell you what, here's the deal though. If people haven't seen it yet, they're going to want to see it just from listening to us because it's so good. And if they've seen it, they're just laughing along with us. Because you haven't given away any big spoilers like but that taser moment was so awesome. It was so perfect.
And just as soon as she does it, everybody freaks out and she's like, oh, come on, she's the worst. It's great.
Patricia speaks for all of us in that moment.
She does. Everybody's had people that they felt that way about before and wanted to tase.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
They're so mean to her. And you know what? That's not to bring things down, but it's true. Like, people can be like that. Like, 100%. You think that you leave that behind in high school. Not necessarily. There are people who are just mean, who just really like to be mean.
And, like, exclusionary. But yeah, those people they're quite realistically written, unfortunately, those characters.
Exclusionary. That's the best word for it. You're right. Yep. And that's just one of the worst forms of unkindness, I think.
It is.
Right. Oh, so painful. We've all been through it. Most of us have.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
So next time you come on the podcast, we're just going to break down Widow's Bay.
The whole season. We'll do a rewatch before. Or when with season two comes out, we'll do a watch through.
Oh, my God. Yes.
And we'll talk about this season.
That's amazing. Well, just put this on your radar. I'm not being Patricia barging into your party. But my next big release for a novel is in July. And it's The Stars Have Left the Skies, which is a winter horror novel. And ooh. So if you all are interested, I don't know if Widow's Bay 2 will be out by then. Probably not. But yeah, like I'd love to, you know, I'm sure we'll have watched more by then. But just throwing that out there, because I've loved seeing you both with these releases. It's been a blast.
Perfect. Hey, thank you for plugging it in. If you have anything else that you're working on, please do let us know. Absolutely. Feel free.
Yeah. Always and if you want to actually, do you want to let people know? I mean, one, it seems like they can find Marla basically anywhere that they buy books now, which is fantastic. And then on top of that, do you want to let people know where they can find you if they want to follow you for updates or anything?
Yeah. Basically anywhere online. Jonathan.Jans on Instagram is maybe where I am the most. But I'm all on all the social media platforms. And one other thing about like plugging Marla with the audiobook, if any of you ever have any interest in audiobooks, you have to listen to the audiobook of Marla. Not even kidding. So Sean Patrick Hopkins did Lenora, my story in The End of the World as We Know It, the Stephen King anthology for The Stand. Mm-hmm. So I already knew that guy. And when I heard he was going to narrate some of the voices in Marla, I was just so excited because he killed, that's the wrong word to use. He did an amazing job with Lenora. I didn't want to make that unintentionally macabre, but he was amazing with Lenora. So I was so excited. But then when I heard Patricia Santomaso was going to do the other voices, I went online and listened to her and she was amazing. But she today, I was listening to her in this one scene. This is going to sound weird and sound like I'm plugging my own work, but it's genuinely true. It was during my lunch. So I was grading papers, eating and listening. And she, in one scene, she made me laugh really hard, like belly laugh. And then by the end of the scene, she made me cry. I started to cry at the end of the scene because she just delivered this. She was playing the part of Annie, this mother who's one of the protagonists. And she just had such pathos in her performance, just such heart in the performance that I was in tears at the end. I'm like, oh my gosh, I've got to go collect myself before my students come back in because they're going to think I've had some tragedy and it's my own audiobook. Right. So yeah. Anyway, so if any of you are audiobook people at all, you got to hear it. It's next level amazing.
Oh, I love that. I love that audiobook narrators are getting more traction than they used to. And they're like, you know, getting their own platforms and their audiences and things like that. It's something I've noticed over the last few years. And it's really nice to see that because audiobooks are fantastic and they make reading accessible for people who maybe just, you know, aren't able to get through a physical book.
I agree. And I think it's also something that people don't appreciate maybe enough because, and this is, I'm not throwing shade, like people, it's a compliment to me. Because I read my work aloud at events and I read to my students and stuff. And people are like, well, you know, you seem to be comfortable. Why don't you narrate your own books? And they mean that in a totally complimentary way. And that's how I take it. But like my deep down thought is, you don't know how hard it is. Like you don't know what these people are doing, like how much skill is involved, how much better they are than me. That's not false modesty. That's just honesty. Because it is as much a performance as being on stage or being in a movie or a show. Like it is such a skill set. And people who are audiobook narrators are just, they just really awe me. Because in a way, they have to, if you look at it from it, almost do more than an actor does visually because they do it with less. Like Jimmy Stewart in Rear Window has to act in a wheelchair, right? And so he can't move around the way an actor would in a normal performance, the way that he would in a normal performance. So that almost makes what he does more impressive. An audiobook narrator, you can't see it all. And so like Steven Weber, who narrated it, like it's all in his voice. Yeah. Like the inflection, the silences, the different voices, the different emotions, the different rhythms. It's like, I feel like I've been to Hamlet on Broadway after I listened to it because Steven Weber absolutely just lives that performance. He lives that book. And I feel like Patricia and Sean do too in this case. Like, it's really an awe-inspiring set of skills that they have.
That's awesome.
It's true.
This is the best plug possible. Everybody read the book and listen to the audiobook also.
And buy the hardcover because it is beautiful.
Yeah, that I'd love to get my hands on a copy.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Please. Please. I could not agree more.
Perfect. So thank you so much for joining us and for your time.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes.
You two are awesome. Yeah. I could talk to you for hours, and I will talk to you anytime you'll have me back. So awesome. I love talking to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.